Welcome to the Global Minnesota Podcast, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesota with the world. This episode is a recording of a public event held on January 31st, 2024, at the University of Minnesota. Every year, Global Minnesota hosts the annual U.S. Foreign Policy Update, featuring diplomat-in-residence Tom Hansen. He explores and discusses the latest foreign policy developments and what to look out for in the year ahead. The event drew over 500 registered guests, with hundreds joining both virtually and in person. Tom discussed a wide range of topics, including the repercussions from the ongoing war in Ukraine, concerns facing China's economy, renewed conflict in the Middle East, and ongoing global struggles for peace and security. Audience questions were collected and compiled into a bonus Q&A podcast episode, which will be released in the next week. Here is the 2024 U.S. Foreign Policy Update, featuring diplomat-in-residence Tom Hansen.
Thank you so much, Marcia, and thank you, Phil. Wonderful to see everyone tonight on this lovely afternoon. Why it's so warm, we'll have to talk about later. But anyway, 2024, here we are. I'm reminded of the old Betty Davis film, you know, fasten your seatbelts for this year. I wasn't too sure how to approach the speech, so I decided for the first time to use ChatGPT-4. And so I gave it a prompt. I said, explain the world in 2024 for a large audience. And there was a long hesitation. And finally, on the screen, this thing bubbled up and said, ask later. So so I guess I'm on my own, is what I'm saying. There's a lot to cover tonight. The first thing I'll mention is something positive, and I'm going to try to conclude with something positive too. I take no responsibility for what's in between. This is a year of many, many elections. In fact, unprecedented number of elections around the world. I mean, the calculations vary from 60 countries and 3 billion people to this estimation here of 54. It depends on whether you count just democracies, although it's kind of hard to define these days, or whether you include Russia and other countries which are having elections this year. But I mean, it's an encouraging thing that the world is, in so many countries, including our own, exercising a certain amount of freedom in electing. So you can see it's broken down there by the different kinds of polities. A very important election has already taken place on January 13th in Taiwan. The Russian election will be in the middle of March. India is on the docket, and of course, ours coming up as well. Now, our election is provoking a fair amount of uncertainty, concern, and when it comes to the Europeans, panic. I don't know if you follow The Economist magazine, but they're starting to almost conclude which way the election will probably go. And so many countries are facing conflict situations today, as we know. And this is the time of year when various organizations come out with their sort of lists of the greatest risks that are being faced. And so one of these is the Council on Foreign Relations in New York does an annual risk assessment. And here you can see the risks for this year. They break them down into categories. The highest category in red is high likelihood, high impact. And so those are the ones in red. And the number one risk this year is the growing polarization in the US, the potential for political violence ahead of the elections coming. And this is ahead of issues like Hamas, Israel, immigration surge, Ukraine. I think this is a bit overblown. But the Eurasia Group with Ian Bremmer also issues its risk assessment, and they also have us number one. US versus itself is their number one threat. So, you know, I'm looking pretty banged up tonight. I apologize for that. But maybe I can be kind of a visual aid for what might happen in this coming year, depending on how we rise above our demons, how we rise above our polarization. The world is watching to see how we handle this. So I will focus tonight on a number of these issues. So kind of a roadmap for the presentation. I'll obviously spend a good deal of time on Ukraine and update the various spin-off effects that are happening there. Number two, China. And I want to say that China is interwoven into many of the issues and conflicts today. The bipartisan focus on China in Washington means that we are seeing many issues around the world in terms of China. All of our embassies around the world are tasked with monitoring what China's doing in their country. They have people whose job description includes that. And so China obviously is very important. China is pursuing a geoeconomic policy. We tend to focus on geopolitics and military. It's like checkers and chess, if you will. And so I'll try to explain how China is interwoven and what the policies are. Third, Gaza, how can we avoid that? And the regional dynamics that are flowing from that. China plays a big role, passive but important role in the run-up to Gaza, which I'll try to explain, that so many things are interconnected today. So I'll try to give a background on how we got to where we are in Gaza. Fourth, U.S. industrial policy, which is taking on new forms even since last year. We are really engaged now in a tech competition with China, which has a greater role for the state in what we're doing. This is provoking a backlash among neoliberals, which I'll describe. And the de-risking that we are engaged in from China is being seen by, for example, the IMF as merely an inflationary reshuffling of global trade. So I'll try to elucidate that a bit more. And then interconnected factors of climate, immigration, and populism. Or, as Donald Trump phrased it when he was introduced to the concept of populism by Steve Bannon, popularism, which is how he interpreted that idea. And so finally then, just very shortly at the end, aspects of AI and how that is in coming into our politics. Many of you maybe saw the hearings today, which were quite dramatic with the heads of the various tech companies. And then finally, as I promised, I will end on a somewhat hopeful note. And believe it or not, that hopeful note will involve China. So that's basically where we're going. Now, as I mentioned, China is interwoven with all these things. Yes, there's a strategic triangle that we are dealing with now. China and Russia are getting closer together. And so how we manage that going forward will be key. The demographics are clear, as are the economics. I think the basic issue is, and this kind of mega history of economics chart shows you this, China was the largest economy in the world for most of human history, just by dint of its size and degree of development. We surpassed them in the late 1880s, and we have been the number one economy in the world ever since. Well, depending on how you measure GDP, China surpassed us already in about 2015 in purchasing power parity. Now, this is not going down well in Washington, as you can imagine. There is a strong impulse to try to maintain a certain, if you want to call it, hegemony. Added to that is the sense of a technology challenge from China. Now, China's current situation is not all roses. I mean, there are many economic difficulties. Growth is not as strong as it was. There's youth unemployment. There's a real estate bubble. Our tech onslaught, if you will, is not making things easier for them. And also, their population, of course, is declining. I think I showed this slide last year. It hasn't changed. China peaking now at about 1.4 billion people. By the end of this century, its population will be cut in half to 770,000, based on the best UN estimate at this point. Things can change, of course. So this is, China is dealing with a lot of problems. Now, the other theme, in addition to China being interwoven, before I get into the main topics now, has to do with the Global South. And here you can see the very basic fact that the global population now is shifting dramatically in the course of this century. What you would call the global South is going to be by far the majority. The West, the G7 even, down to about 8% of the population. So more and more people are realizing that the global South is the key to the future. Africa, other parts of the world. The Chinese and the Russians are all over this. They have been, they're kind of devising their policies on this basis. We are just beginning to wake up to it in Washington now. So the global South will be a very important part of the future. And that's the other underlying theme. It's interesting that the two sort of grand old men, both now deceased, before they passed away, Henry Kissinger just this year, but Zbigniew Brzezinski in 2017, came out with admonitions as they were leaving the stage about what we needed to focus on going forward. And for Henry Kissinger, it was very much the idea that we need active diplomacy with other nuclear powers to prevent the worst. He felt at the end that we were taking the nuclear threat lightly in the way we were dealing with the world, in contrast to the Cold War. And of course, this is all the more the case since so many nuclear agreements now have been cast aside in recent years. But for Brzezinski, it was a different admonition. In really the last article that he wrote in 2016 for the American Interest, he focused not on Russia, which is his usual focus, but he said a new historical narrative is emerging. A profound resentment against the West and its colonial legacy all through the global South. A theme like white settler colonialism, which I see on the campus all the time these days, it's actually being invoked in our domestic politics, as you know, is influencing opinions in the global South toward things like Gaza and even toward Ukraine. And so I think that that Brzezinski put his finger on something at the end of his life that was in fact emerging and that would be a huge factor going forward. So with that background, I'll get into the main topics. Ukraine. Here's the very decided Volodymyr Zelensky walking through Congress last month. In the face of the political impasse that we're facing right now on aid to Ukraine, it's quite clear that the Trump campaign has concluded that there should be no compromise in immigration, that it doesn't make sense to give Biden that victory. And that, because they've become linked, this is going to hold up potentially funding for Ukraine at just the wrong moment. This is as of last week, and you can see the lines of control there. Russia has pretty much dug in to the eastern, roughly 20% of Ukraine. The bloodiest battles are going on in places like Bakhmut, there in the center, Avdiivka. During the counteroffensive, Ukraine took very high losses. Tragically, any country that's on the offensive will take higher losses. That's the way military confrontations go. And the current state is very close to what Vladimir Putin has long said was the Russian goal in Ukraine, which is to assure what he calls New Russia, Nova Russia, the parts of Ukraine which are more Russian speaking, and which unfortunately control the Black Sea littoral, potentially turning the rest of Ukraine into a landlocked country. A lot of the industrial capacity of Ukraine is there and some of the best farmland as well. So Ukraine does not want to, obviously, let this be the final result. I think, in my view, maybe I'm wrong, but I think the Russians, this is their goal. I don't think that they want to go all the way to conquer all of Ukraine. I think they realized that that would be a can of worms. Western Ukraine, is culturally different from Eastern Ukraine, a different religion than the Uniat faith. They recognize the Pope over there. They've been under the Habsburg Empire. They've been under Poland in their history. I don't think that that's what the Russians are out for. They may try to continue on to take Odessa and Kharkiv. That is very possible. And that would be a very bad battle if that were to happen. Now, in the face of this, in addition to potentially flagging Western support, you know, there's a paradigm of encouragement and abandonment in our recent foreign policy, which we have to pray does not happen also in Ukraine. It would be a tragic result if that were to happen. Now, in Ukraine, the two most important figures are, of course, Volodymyr Zelensky, but also Valery Zaluzhny, the head of Ukrainian forces. There are growing signs of discord between these two and of a possible crisis, hopefully a manageable one, in Kyiv. There were rumors just in the last 2 days that that President Zelensky tried to fire Zaluzhny. Whether this is true, we don't know, but there are a lot of sources saying this happened and that Zaluzhny refused to step down. Zaluzhny has the support of the former president of Ukraine, Mr. Poroshenko. He is probably more popular in public opinion than Zelensky. It's unclear what his political intentions are. Once again, not a good time for this kind of thing to be happening. Now, Zelensky is the true believer. He insists that the goal is to win back all of the territory that has been lost, including Crimea. And our position in Washington is that it's up to the Ukrainians. We will empower them. It's their choice what to do. Now, Zaluzhny has had a slightly different tone. And this came out last fall when he did an interview with The Economist. He admitted that it was a stalemate, which Zelensky would never admit. And he said something very significant. He said, "We need a quick solution, a speedy victory, because sooner or later, we're going to find out that we simply don't have enough people." And given the losses that Ukraine has suffered during the past year, this is becoming a big issue. Unfortunately, this is a grinding ground war, almost like World War I, of trenches and high casualty rates. The Ukrainian sources, whether they can be believed or not, in the last month or so have said that there may have been up to 500,000 Ukrainian deaths and severely wounded. Once again, hard to say. Bill Burns from the CIA just this week estimated that Russian losses have been about 315,000 killed and wounded. I don't think anybody knows for sure, but on both sides, the losses are high. So this is a war of attrition, if you will. In fact, I think that the Russian policy can be defined right now as aggressive attrition. They dug in to protect what they have, and they're trying to decimate the Ukrainian forces and Ukrainian infrastructure from a kind of a porcupine position, not really trying too much to go on the offensive at this point. The West is having a hard time providing now basic ammunition. We're not geared up for a war like this. Our wars, really since World War I, with Korea being an exception, have been from the air. They've been high-tech. We don't send ground troops in to do the main work, and so we are not, our economy is not geared to what you need for this kind of a war, and it's going to take a lot of time to get back to this. So there's ammunition shortages taking place in Ukraine right now. So what's the way out of this? Because we can't encourage and abandon a country like Ukraine that has sacrificed so much for ideals we believe in. Well, the shift now is over toward more of a high-tech orientation. The British, during the past year, gave the Ukrainians Storm Shadow missiles. This is a Storm Shadow missile. It's fired from airplanes, 155-mile range. It can strike deep into Crimea, but also into Russia itself. And we have given the Ukrainians in the past year ATACMS. That's an acronym. You know, the Pentagon loves acronyms that have some kind of a creepy significance. And so these are ATACMS, which are ground-based, but also have even a longer range. And the idea is to do something that the Biden administration did not dare to do early in the conflict, and that is take the war into Crimea and into Russia itself. The idea early on was that that was too risky, that that might risk even a nuclear response from Russia. Well, we're in a mood now to take the risk. And so Bill Burns, in a recent interview, said that, yes, even though we thought this was too risky before, you know, we can't be intimidated by a nuclear threat. And so we are going to take this war now into Russia. Here you can see there have already been strikes in Belgorod, a major attack on Belgorod in the last weeks. There have been a couple of drone attacks as far as Moscow. They're hitting now Crimea more and more. And this is likely to be the way forward because the Ukrainians are blocked on the ground. And Russia has the upper hand right now on the ground. The US is working on right now a long-term strategy for Ukraine. Elements of it are leaking out. Basic points are there'll be no significant Ukrainian advances in 2024. Ukraine should go into a defensive posture. We will help Ukraine to fend off Russian advances while strengthening its long-term capabilities. So this is a long-term strategy, and it has four phases. This is the way it's defined in the document, which will be released fairly soon. Fight, build, recover, reform. Now, some in Congress would like to see that reform come a little higher because there have been recent reports of corruption. Wartime, I mean, there was so much corruption in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, if you're in a war situation, there's always corruption. That's something that we have to watch carefully, keep popular support for this effort. Now, I mentioned taking the war now, and we're going to be giving the Norwegians at least F-16s to Ukraine. Ukraine needs more air defense, and it needs more control of the skies somehow. So that's also coming in the next year, ideally. But that CFR risk analysis that I mentioned to you before has as their number three risk an escalation of the war in Ukraine resulting from intensified military operations in Crimea, the Black Sea, and Russia, potentially leading to direct NATO involvement. So this is potentially a high-risk strategy if we pursue it as it's being talked about right now. Now, Russia is, of course, upping its missile capability. I think it must be a little bit belittling for the Russians to have to turn to North Korea to get long-range missiles. Of course, they've been using Iranian drones for a good while now. So we'll see how this goes. Meanwhile, every party is tiring. Ukraine is tired of this, obviously, this talk of calling up 500,000 young men. I know several Ukrainians that I've worked with, even doing online conferences with, who are in Spain now because of this potential of a huge new call up of draft age, but that will include up to age 60 at least. So it's very controversial. And it may be a difference between Zaluzhny and Zelensky. Our Congress, for its own reasons, seems tired, and even Russia. So there is a new presidential candidate in Russia, Boris Nadezhdin, who is an anti-war candidate. Now, obviously, Russia is what the Russians call themselves, a managed democracy. It's kind of like the ultimate oxymoron, but there you are. And so would this be happening if it weren't actually, I mean, accepted or even encouraged by the Kremlin? Hard to know. But there are some signs of popular support. Russians have been lining up in cold weather to get the 100,000 signatures needed for his candidacy. They've easily gotten that. And so we'll see how this proceeds until mid-March, whether this candidate is allowed to go all the way and what effect it might have. But it's an indication that under the surface of Putin's 83% popularity, theoretically, there's more going on. And just yesterday, an article appeared by CIA chief Bill Burns in Foreign Policy magazine, really emphasizing this. He says, under the surface, this is gnawing away at the Russian leadership. There's an increasing disaffection in Russia. And then he says, and this is making it easier than ever to recruit spies for the CIA in Russia. And I thought that was kind of an interesting admission or a way of phrasing this. He says that even just advertising on YouTube, they are getting responses. Well, anyway, whether this, why he would say this, I don't know, but there you go. So there are signs that even in Russia, things are tiring to some extent. And of course, the wives of soldiers have been protesting, and that's been allowed to some extent. Now, you know, resulting from Ukraine, this has been a boon to NATO. NATO has never in some ways been stronger. The Biden team has done a good job of alliance management, if you will. The expansion to Sweden and Finland is taking place. Jake Sullivan, I think, summed it up last year when he said, if Ronald Reagan's formula was peace through strength, Joe Biden's formula is peace through American and allied strength. In other words, the allies are integral. Now you can imagine how our allies are looking at the election coming up here. John Bolton in his memoirs says flat out that Trump in his second term would have pulled the US out of NATO. That is Bolton's assertion. Whether he's right, I don't know. But he was just on CNN today saying that. Now the other aspect, and here we're coming to the global south and very gradually now to Gaza. Whether it's because of this resentment that Brzezinski put his finger on, the global south has simply not supported us on Ukraine. They have not taken part in sanctions. A number of African leaders have actually said that the different treatment that we're giving to Ukrainians compared to conflicts in the global south is an example of racism. Why does CNN go granular on Ukraine, but not on all the other crises that are out there? As I said, the Russians and the Chinese are doing very well on this basis. They talk about the global majority, how they themselves are oppressed by the West. Just like, I mean, China can say that perhaps more with a straighter face than Russia. Although Russia is saying, look, it's NATO, it's that old group of colonists in Western Europe that are encroaching on us, just like they encroached on you. So Putin is has a lot of fans in the global south. The Russians had a huge Africa summit a few months ago, very well attended. He's actually got a lot of support out in the global south, obviously unlike in the West. Now, another spinoff from the conflict has been our use of sanctions, our decision to seize Russian state assets parked in the West, about $325 billion worth. We have frozen them, we have not taken them yet, but there's more and more discussion of taking this money and using it to rebuild Ukraine, which would make a lot of sense morally. Why not? Economists are saying, whoa, be careful. This would set such a precedent that it might begin to undermine the dollar, because our sanctions are based on the role of the dollar in the world. And lo and behold, this fall, Janet Yellen, who was the most fearsome weapon in our arsenal, way beyond the ATACMS. She has her hand on the sanctions, right, which have had such an impact. Speaking before Congress, Janet Yellen said, "The one thing we have to keep in mind, sanctions have motivated some countries to seek alternatives to the dollar. We should expect a decline in the dollar as the world, as a world reserve currency." And she pointed out that just in the past year, the dollar has declined 8% as a reserve currency. She said this is a natural desire of other countries to diversify. And she, I think she was sanguine, thinking that when these crises are over, there's no alternative to the dollar ultimately. But is that true? And that's what we're going to find out. Now, there are smoke, there's smoke. Whether there's a fire, I don't know. Already this past year, Saudi Arabia and Russia agreed to move toward a petro yuan to avoid the dollar in their transactions. You know, China's the number one purchaser now of Saudi resources. At the BRICS summit in Johannesburg, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, it's not an alliance. China does not believe in alliances. China believes in ententes. It doesn't want the responsibility of having allies. It sees them as ultimately a liability. At this summit in Johannesburg, a number of important initiatives were announced. Number one, the BRICS announced that they are now moving toward a gold-backed cryptocurrency. Now, is this realistic? I mean, we're not going to be using this in TravelX, but it might be used for transactions, you know, sort of internal transactions among companies, even among countries, potentially. China's gone quite far in crypto. They banned all private crypto in their country. They've been buying gold. I think the idea is to use some Russian assets to back this up too. Is this realistic? Well, we'll see. The next summit will be in Kazan in Russia in October. And we'll see whether there's any follow-up. Now, more fatefully, in terms of the crises we're facing, and here's where, as I say, China comes in, interwoven into everything. At that same meeting in Johannesburg, the BRICS announced a major expansion. Six new countries, actually five now. Many of them in the Middle East. So Egypt, Iran, Saudi Arabia, UAE have all joined the BRICS. Argentina did too, but when Milei was elected, he put it on pause. This has got Washington very concerned because there are many examples now of China coming in economically and politically into the Middle East and having great influence. And Saudi Arabia is key in this. In the past year, the Chinese, or as Wang Yi, managed to reconcile Saudi Arabia and Iran to recognize each other and to begin relations. And actually, in the current Gaza crisis, they've been communicating very closely on a lot of things. This was brokered by China. Now, obviously, we, given our allegiances in the Middle East, where we're seen maybe not totally balanced, we could not have done this, right? So Washington is, the Biden administration is, on to this, is concerned about this, and it is part of the run-up to Gaza. The way we have reacted to this Chinese incursion into the Middle East. So lo and behold, at the G20 meeting in India this fall, a subgroup announced a major new initiative, clearly to counter China, the India Middle East Europe Economic Corridor. Now, how realistic this is, I don't know, but it's a major plank in the Biden foreign policy. This is how it would look. It would come, this would be linking India. You know, China has the Belt and Road going on in Eurasia. This would be a way of countering that to some extent, coming through Saudi Arabia, of all places, through the Middle East, Jordan, Israel, where it would probably be kind of nice to have some stability to enable this new corridor. Now, I'm just going to regress for a moment here, because the history of what's happened in the Middle East, our position toward the Palestinians and the tragedies that are going on. You know, ever since 1948 with the UN resolutions and in our foreign policy, a two-state solution has been a centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy. And certain administrations have actually pushed quite hard for a two-state solution that would recognize the rights and the dignity of the Palestinians. So the Oslo Accords, of course, were a high watermark. The last time that the U.S. made any kind of a push toward a two-state solution was in 2014, when Obama brought together Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas. It hit a brick wall over the settlements issue, as one might imagine. And at that point, the Obama team turned away from Israel-Palestine and toward Iran and the idea of an Iran nuclear deal. And so the rest of that administration was not focused on the Palestinian issue at all. It had other priorities. When Trump came in, it wasn't just neglect. It was actually aggressive behavior toward the Palestinians. Trump's first visit as president was to Saudi Arabia. We all remember when Ivanka opened up the new American embassy in Jerusalem, something that no other president had dared to do. That, by the way, is when Netanyahu gave his famous speech in which he said, Israel no longer needs the support of the Jewish community in the United States. It can rely on the evangelical community worldwide. And I think that still is, ultimately, because in Congress, it is very much the evangelicals who are the most supportive of Israel now. And the Jewish community is divided, as we all see, on Israel. So the Trump team took a different approach, neglecting the Palestinians totally. It went for the Abraham Accords, the idea that you reconcile the Arab countries with Israel, it'll lead to economic growth and things will trickle down to the region, including to the Palestinians. It's like trickle-down economics. And Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, was the guy heading this up, and he often framed it in those terms. The Democrats criticized this, saying that that this ignored the basic issues in the Middle East. And so when Biden came in, he was not in favor of this approach. And in fact, he was labeling Mohammed bin Salman a pariah. We began to investigate his role in the Khashoggi murder. No contact with the Saudis. But then they started to see what was happening with China and the fact that Saudi Arabia was gravitating toward China. And a total reversal of policy took place. The famous fist bump heard around the world. Biden went to Canossa, basically met with MBS. And the new initiative, along with this new corridor, became to reconcile Saudi Arabia and Israel, continue the Abraham Accords, which they had been opposed to first, and basically ignore the Palestinians. Nothing about the Palestinians in this new initiative. So you can see here these corridor wars, the various ones that the Chinese have going, the North-South corridor, and then this new idea of our foreign policy, which we want to come through here, Jordan and Israel, and then on to Europe. Now, a rather embarrassing moment took place in early October when Foreign Policy Magazine came out with an article by Jake Sullivan outlining U.S. foreign policy. And and making the rather sanguine assertion that the Middle East region is quieter now than it has been in decades. And by the way, that article mentioned nothing about anything about the Palestinians, not a word about a two-state solution. Basically, that had fallen by the wayside. Now, many people think that what happened at the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount may have had something to do with October 7th. In fact, it's called Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. That's the name that the Palestinians gave to it. But that probably is not the context for which to understand what they did. I'll get to that in just a minute. Now, the initial reaction of the Biden team to this was to fully embrace Israel. in order to moderate their behavior and to deter a regional conflict. As Tony Blinken said, we're going to give Israel advice that only a friend can give, right? So the first meetings right after October 7th looked like a planning session to much of the world. We sent the world's largest aircraft carrier, the Gerald Ford, and Biden himself went to the Middle East to literally embrace Netanyahu. Now, the problem is that having done this, we're kind of left dangling because our advice to the Israelis had not particularly been followed. And the fact that we've had to veto UN resolutions brings up this resentment of the global South. An African diplomat said to Reuters not long ago, they, the West, lose credibility with that veto. What is good enough for Ukraine is not good enough for Palestine. The veto told us that Ukrainian lives are more valuable than Palestinian ones. So the whole idea of a rules-based order and a kind of a basic equality is losing its credibility, quite frankly, in the developing world. Now, ironically, and here's the big shift, and here's where, I'm going to describe where we are now. That Foreign Affairs magazine, which mentioned nothing about two-state solution, the Biden administration contacted Foreign Affairs magazine and said, could we insert a new paragraph in your online edition of that article? And that new paragraph describes a two-state solution. So kind of ex post facto. And Biden has said two interesting things. First of all, and this gets into the causation of October 7th, he said, I believe that one of the reasons Hamas struck when they did was they knew that I was working very closely with the Saudis and others in the region to bring peace to the region. In other words, the shift toward the Abraham Accords. By having recognition of Israel and Israel's right to exist. And Hamas leaders have said that is the reason that they struck. They were trying to scuttle this final reconciliation between really their final ally, Saudi Arabia, and I hate to say this, but it kind of worked. Because as Biden has said, there's no going back to the status quo as it stood on October 6th. When this crisis is over, there has to be a vision of what comes next. And in our view, it has to be a two-state solution. Suddenly, the two-state solution, which has been gone since 2014, is a centerpiece of US policy. And by the way, a number of countries, 138 countries, have recognized Palestine. The UK this week has said that they are open to possibly recognizing a Palestinian state. And in the news this afternoon, there are leaks saying that the Biden administration now is studying the legalities of moving toward official recognition of a Palestinian state. If that happens, that is huge. And I can't believe that it will, but who knows. But the tone has really shifted. Tony Blinken met way out in the desert in a royal tent with Mohammed bin Salman. And when he came out, this is what our Secretary of State said. Israel's integration into the region is not a substitute for a political horizon for the Palestinians and ultimately a Palestinian state. That peace has to be part of any integration efforts, any normalization efforts. Israel must stop taking steps that undercut the Palestinians' ability to govern themselves effectively. Settler violence, settler expansion, home demolitions, and evictions all make it harder, not easier, for Israel to achieve lasting peace and security. This is a whole new tone that has come into US foreign policy, and it's being developed in coordination with Saudi Arabia, with the EU, and others. Even as we still are facilitating the onslaught on Hamas and on Gaza, which probably has caused about 26,000 deaths so far. Now, as one might imagine, Netanyahu has flatly rejected this idea. And I know many people in Israel simply cannot imagine a two-state solution at this point after all that's happened. As Netanyahu is saying, that the goal is full Israeli security control of all territory west of the Jordan River. And in an editorial on Christmas Day in the Wall Street Journal, he set out three goals: destroy Hamas completely, demilitarize Gaza, and this is a tough one, de-radicalize Palestinian society. that could be a long-term goal. Now, there are different tones coming out of the Israeli military, interestingly enough. Some senior military leaders have talked about maybe some kind of a mixed situation in the Gaza Strip with a greater role for the Palestinians. So we'll see where this goes. Northern Gaza has been thoroughly attacked. The fighting now is around Khan Yunis. There are indications that the Israelis are scaling back a bit, but they're moving troops north to the border with Hezbollah in Lebanon. The Egypt factor has been very important because early on, I think the Israelis asked Sisi of Egypt whether he would open the border to receive Palestinian refugees. The Egyptians saw a second Nakba looming, you know, in 1948, a lot of Palestinians went to Jordan and never came back. And the Egyptians basically said no to that. Right-wing leaders in the government still talk about this option of expulsion. And of course, we've been following the International Court of Justice trial. Once again, it's brought by the Global South, putting Israel on the docket. I see that Namibia now has used this to raise again German genocide in Namibia in the early 20th century, which Germany has admitted. So this, as I say, the Global South is voting heavily in favor of a ceasefire at a minimum. Now, the possibility of a regional conflict exists, of course. You've got the Houthis saying that they will keep firing on shipping until there's a ceasefire in Gaza. They're well dug in. They've been bombed by the Saudis for years and years. They used to be bombed. And so what we're doing so far is not having any effect. This is very expensive, very inflationary, as ships are having to be rerouted long distances. And so we're hoping somehow to get this under control, but it may not get under control until there's a ceasefire. Meanwhile, other parts just close to the region are festering between Iran and Pakistan. There was a rather surprising exchange of military fire in Baluchistan, a very interesting part of the world. Parts of it in Afghanistan, parts in Pakistan, parts in Iran. The Iranians accuse the Pakistanis of allowing anti-Iranian groups to operate in their part of Baluchistan. Pakistan then made the same kind of allegation. My understanding is there's still some low-level backing and forthing. These two countries have been very careful to try to keep their relations on an even keel, and I doubt if it'll get under control, but it's just one more uncertainty in the region. I think we should watch northern Israel. Israel is sending forces up there. There are low-level attacks going back and forth. The United States does not want to draw Hezbollah and into the conflict. They have Beirut bombed. And of course, the tragic drone strike in Jordan, just next to Syria, which killed three American servicemen and women. And of course, this is a red line. And we're all waiting now to see exactly what the response will be. It'll probably be a stage by stage. It's going to be a sort of a spread out response. Indications are that we won't dare to go into Iran, but you could see Iranian assets outside of Iran hit. The whole conundrum is, this map sums it up, you've got these various groups, the Axis of Resistance, all financed by Iran. And there's no question that that Iran has empowered these groups and has weaponized them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it directs their activity on specific actions. That's harder to document. And Iran is claiming that it was caught by surprise by October 7th, and actually our intelligence indicates the same. Bill Burns has said that, yes, they were caught by surprise, and it was not a directed operation from Iran. But nonetheless, Iran is, in many ways, the font of this, and voices in Congress are increasingly calling for a direct attack on Iran. I don't think that's going to happen this time, but it remains. Now, very quickly to get through that, I think I have a few more minutes. Shifting gears to the U.S.-China semiconductor wars. As I say, maybe the greatest concern about China in Washington is the fact there are more and more indications that China is moving ahead of us in key technologies. And these technologies all have military implications. the Australian Strategic Policy Institute this past year issued a shocking report claiming that China now leads in 37 of the 44 leading technologies. I'd be surprised if that's true, but you never know. They certainly are doing very well in areas like quantum. Already several years ago, they launched a quantum satellite. And just this fall, it was announced that China and Russia are testing a hack-proof quantum communication link to use in the BRICS context. Quantum communication cannot be hacked. And so whoever gets this first has a huge leg up. I'm sure that we are researching the same kind of technologies, but this is further along in terms of applications of this technology. Now, so as a result, as I'm sure you've all seen, we have now launched certain policies, economic policies, to try to slow China down. A very important speech was given by Jake Sullivan on April 27th at Brookings about the international agenda. And basically, he said, look, we've made a huge mistake in the past decades. We've privileged finance over the more essential parts of our economy, infrastructure, tech, semiconductors. Our industrial base has been hollowed out. This must stop, and there must be a greater role for government. We cannot rely on corporations to understand the security implications of what they are working on. And then he said, we must move beyond free trade to innovative partnerships, whatever that means. We must protect our foundational technologies. You know, there are a lot of continuities actually between the Trump foreign policies and Biden, not just on the Abraham Accords now. And so the kind of the neoliberals are up in arms about this. Bob Zoellick, former head of the World Bank, has been especially sharp, saying that the Biden team is a bunch of revolutionaries. They're seeking an ideological transformation of our economy. They're spending irresponsibly. The stimuluses to attract tech are up to 10% of GDP. They're ignoring price signals. They're building on Trump's tariffs. Bob Zoellick is not happy. But even less enthused is The Economist magazine. I don't know how many ways you can say this is an anathema, but that is what The Economist says almost every week. Most recently, our free markets history, they call it homeland economics. And they accuse the US of pursuing now a protectionist, high subsidy, intervention heavy, ideologically infused policy administered by an ambitious state. Well, and in fact, they've gone so far as to compare this to the 1930s, not the rise of Hitler, but rather the breakdown of the global economy in the 1930s, which led to Hitler. Well, okay, so you expect the neoliberals to be upset, and maybe we need more industrial policy, but that's where the debate stands. As you know, Trump is talking about at least a 10% tariff on everything when he comes in, and more trade restrictions. It's true the debt is rising fast. It's at $34 trillion now. Which is something at some point we're going to have to either cut back or raise taxes or do something. Now, China, and this is China's, what China's telling the administration. You know, there was an article about how China now is more active at the state level, including in Minnesota. And we've had Chinese representatives out here in terms of cooperation. And I think that the idea is this: China has three priorities. Number one, relations with the US. They realize it'll be up and down, but they want to keep it within a certain band, not let it spiral down. Number one priority. Number two, relations in Asia, especially trade. And number three and last, Russia, Belt and Road, Eurasia. That's important, but not as important as the other two. And so we can see that China, even as we're pulling back, they are really investing now in the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which was signed a few years ago. You can see who the members are. This lowers the barriers for supply chains. And Chinese factories now, partly because of our sanctions, are moving to countries like Vietnam, India, and Mexico in order to keep selling to the US customers while avoiding US tariffs. They're doing it through middlemen or middlewomen or middle countries. And this is why the IMF says, this is not de-risking. The West, the United States, is not de-risking itself from the Chinese market. It merely is facing a reshuffling, an inflationary reshuffling, in which now there are middle countries in between. Congress is starting to look at this, but so far, that's what's happening. So last fall, for the first time since China's opening, it did more trade with the developing world than with the US, Europe, and Japan combined. China is orienting itself more and more toward the global south. And also already in 2019, China's trade with Southeast Asia was higher than its trade with the US. So these are major shifts that are quietly happening. Now, very last part here, and there, well, maybe a couple of questions, I hope. Yes, welcome to the Anthropocene. Behind all of this, you've got the whole climate issue. Last year was the hottest on record. We hit the 1.5 centigrade increase during the past year, which is what we're supposed to avoid. You know, if you look at the flashpoints, depending on how much global warming, we're already in a range for some of the things up there. The permafrost, Labrador solar gyre, whatever that is, sea ice in the north and south, that's already happening, but there's a lot more that could happen. And the UN has cited certain risk tipping points, six of them. I won't go into all of them, but I mean, there are things like, yes, extinctions are increasing, the mountain glaciers are melting, and an interesting one, an uninsurable future, that growing parts of the world now will be uninsurable because companies will not go in and insure places that have this kind of climate risk. And obviously it's pressing, it's not the only factor pressing migration, but it's one of them. And that's by the number three risk for the Council on Foreign Relations was immigration surges at the US border and in Europe. This is the estimation of where global warming will impact most. And as you can see, right across Africa. And lo and behold, this part of Africa is getting more and more destabilized. There have been a series of coups, Mali in 2020, Burkina Faso 2022, Niger 2023, which was a major base for the West against Al-Qaeda in Africa. So this whole part of Africa is getting destabilized. And just a couple of weeks ago, Niger broke its agreement with other countries about trying to limit migration. So now immigrants are free to go through Niger up toward the coast and try to get onto Europe. You know, a lot of the migration from Africa is within Africa. You can see in green, it's migrants within, but in blue, it's migrants out to other countries. And so the European Union is having emergency meetings about this. Now, on our southern border, obviously, big things are happening. There was a meeting with Lopez Obrador just a couple weeks ago in Mexico City. We're trying to get Mexico to help more. Lopez Obrador actually stated some tall demands. For example, immediately $20 billion from the US to the countries of Latin America that are producing immigrants, an immediate recognition of Cuba and stopping the blockade of Cuba, and lifting the sanctions on Venezuela. Not too likely to happen, but this is and of course, the United States now is dealing, 300,000 showed up at the border in December, many more coming from Ecuador, Venezuela. A lot of Ecuadorians are coming to the Twin Cities, many of them by bus from New York. And I have friends working in the sector to receive immigrants, and there are a lot of people coming in. Now, this is causing right, and I'm just about over here, right-wing populist parties to flow into power. So here is Geert Wilders, who's the new prime minister of Netherlands. Le Pen now leads Macron in the polling in France. One bright spot has been Donald Tusk coming in Poland, although he faces a strong opposition still. But the real country to watch and the country that is shaking right now is Germany. And this is a central ally. And what happens there is very fateful. The Germans are waking up to the fact that their economy has been seriously disrupted by the Ukraine war, by cut off of energy, cut off of markets in China. There's talk of deindustrialization of Germany, which is too strong, but still the radical forces are stirring powerfully in Germany on the right and on the left. These are farmers protesting in Berlin recently. A lot of the green policies that we all need actually hurt the working class most in the first phase. And so there's a lot of popular resistance to green policies, which is picked up on by right-wing groups. The main group in Germany is the AfD. Here you can see the demonstrations for something they call re-immigration. Their plans to, if they ever came into power, radically force immigrants, even citizens who are from other countries, out. These are the leaders. There was a meeting recently in which the leadership members of the party participated in a meeting on re-immigration, as it's called. Huge deportation plans. This is a scandal. There have been large protests, and there's a growing push now to ban the AfD. The AfD is at 22% nationally, and it's toward 40% in parts of East Germany. Can you ban a party like that? Is it possible to ban a candidate that has that much popular support? That's the issue. And June 9th elections for the European Parliament will tell the tale. Very briefly, COP28, the US made a lot of promises, but we're the number one LNG producer now for Europe, especially. Biden is being pressed to open up new facilities of LNG. He decided not to do this. He put it on pause, but there's great pressure for us to really go against all of our promises. Now, final point, and I see this at the university and elsewhere. This is an issue that's it's a generational thing. And there's a generational divide that's opening up. A recent NBC poll showed that among 18 to 34 year olds in the US, 70% oppose Biden's foreign policies. For a lot of young people, geopolitics just doesn't compute. It's all about climate and sustainability. And there are certain candidates that are playing on this. And I'll sort of come to an end here. We don't see Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's pretty much not allowed on the mainstream. But a young person today would no more look at CNN than they'd jump off a bridge. I mean, for them, it's old people looking at geriatric politicians awash in a sea of pharmaceutical commercials. I mean, why would a young person watch that? So they're all on YouTube, TikTok, and that's where Robert F. Kennedy is. And so just last week, Gallup showed in the favorability ratings, he now is pretty far ahead of everybody else. Now, I think that once he's actually exposed, he's rather an odd candidate, and so I think that he probably won't have legs. But I do think that there'll be third-party candidates that will make it to the end this time, just like Ross Perot did. And that's going to throw things into a cocked hat, if I'm right. Last point, I promise. Davos this year, the main theme was rebuilding trust. Yep, that's the basis of democracy. Many people feel that the new media erodes trust. Sam Altman was there from OpenAI, was grilled upon this. And I mean, he's one of the main voices for monetizing these technologies right away. So he basically said, yeah, you know, we're gonna have human level AI, but it won't change the world as much as we think. Well, can we trust Sam to say that? I'm sure you all saw our own Dean Phillips, the bot, that AI bot that pretended to be Dean Phillips, was informed about his policies. You can interact with it. With a caveat, it's possible it will say things that are wrong, incorrect, or shouldn't be said. Sounds like a lot of politicians, actually. But anyway, OpenAI demanded that this be brought down. Now, the final optimistic idea, good things happening with China, believe it or not, after the San Francisco summit. There's cooperation now on fentanyl, very important, on climate, military to military contacts. This is all good. And the Taiwan election, which people worried was going to inflame things, actually has calmed things down. It was a mixed result. A different party controls the legislature. So I think there are signs in Taiwan that they see this encouragement abandonment syndrome happening in Ukraine. And they're starting to wonder if they really want to be dragged down that path. So anyway, I think that that's actually a positive, because China is interwoven with everything. And if that relationship is more stable, it's to the good. So thanks, everybody. I'm finished, really finished. Thank you.
So we do have a couple of quick questions, Tom. If you want to stay here for 1 minute, and then I want to let you know that if you have, come on over here. If we have other questions from all of you, please write them down, because we're going to try something kind of new this year. We have a podcast at Global Minnesota. So any questions Tom can't get to tonight, we're going to take those back with us. Tom has graciously agreed to answer those questions in the podcast. And so you'll get a chance to actually listen in on that and hear responses.
You might get to ask again.
Yeah, we have. So ask him some tough ones. So we have question number one, Tom, here is, what do you see as one of the two foreign policy issues facing the U.S. that aren't receiving media attention?
Okay, well, I sort of adumbrated this a little bit, but you know, the whole nuclear issue. I mean, we are in a more perilous situation in terms of a potential nuclear incident between countries than we've been since the Cold War, for sure, since early in the Cold War. And a lot of the key treaties, INF, Open Skies, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the things that were carefully crafted during the Cold War, have fallen by the wayside. And for me, there's just a tone in Washington that's like, oh, what the heck, let's take the risk. Let's, you know, Ukraine, okay, let's push this, or, you know. I guess that's something that I wish, during the Cold War, there was a lot of focus on the nuclear threat, right? And people were aware of arms control. It's just disappeared now. So, and then the other thing, I think, yeah, what's happening in Africa? You know, we're not covering it much. The administration is trying to get more involved in Africa. Tony Blinken was just on a four-country tour. But I wish our media outlets would inform us more about what's happening in that important rising part of the world. The problem is the media focus. There tends to be a master narrative always among the outlets, and it's a fairly narrow one, actually, when you think about it. So apart from that, finally, the situation in Ecuador. You know, a lot of the drug activity has moved away from Colombia, where there's been a kind of a crackdown, and suddenly it's happening in Ecuador and is destabilizing that country. We need more focus because we're going to receive now a lot more immigrants from Ecuador, from Venezuela, not just from Central America. And as you know, it's a big domestic issue for our politics.
We'll take this as last question, Tom. This particular question actually warms my heart. There is an increasing move towards subnational or city diplomacy. What do you see as the role of cities, states, and municipalities on the national stage? Even Minnesota's role on the national stage, potentially.
Yeah, I think it's increasingly important, as you're saying. I mentioned the fact that relations with China are taking a lot of activity now at the local level, whether it's student exchanges, city-to-city changes. I know the mayor, for example, of Edina has been very active in international city diplomacy, other mayors too. For a long time, key initiatives on climate have taken place at the local level. I think that that, whether you call it citizen-to-citizen diplomacy or city-to-city, it's something that is becoming increasingly important. I think Minnesota is at the forefront of a lot of this. We have a lot of connections, a lot of volunteerism, organizations like Global Minnesota, which are forging these contacts. I think it's going to be a very important part of our diplomacy going forward. And by the way, it has to be, because our diplomacy, frankly, is listening to starboard. I mean, really, it's not doing well. We're underfunded. Morale is low at the State Department. There are countries in Africa where the ranking diplomat is a first tour officer, whereas China has 10, 15 times the number. And by the way, something I didn't mention. One last point here. If you look at the Republican Party, not just Trump, there's elements of the party that are gaining strength, which are reminiscent of Robert Taft, Herbert Hoover, the Republican Party in the late 1940s, which was against NATO, against US alliances. Why? Because they believed that they would lead to a large state. And of course it did. It led to the national industrial state. So the Republicans today are questioning our alliances, and they have now a program called Project 2025. Heritage Foundation this is outside of Trump, to basically eviscerate the federal government through something called Schedule F, which will take away all tenure privileges across all agencies and will allow the government to fire at will hundreds of thousands of federal bureaucrats. And the idea is that you need bureaucrats. You know, the deep state has been blocking the Republican agenda. So you need a flexible workforce where you can vet and appoint bureaucrats. It'll be like the United States during the spoils system before the 1883 Civil Service Act. It literally would take us back that far. There's a chance that this will be enacted. They started working on it in the latter years of the Trump administration. And this would be a huge, now how realistic this would be, I mean, the government would just be lamed. There would be a learning curve to this, obviously, but that's the intent. And as I say, it's redolent of an older Republican outlook from the late 1940s, early 1950s.
All right. Well, I tried to give you a softball for a positive at the end there, Tom.
Well, if we're aware of it, we can prevent it. But no, I mean, I thought it was a pretty positive conclusion. I mean, if things are going better with China, hey, that's pretty important.
That is good. So I'll tell you, folks, I came on board, you know, a year ago, and I'm going out and introducing myself to people and to events. And this gentleman comes over, sits down, texts me, and says, I said, I'm Phil Hansen with Global Minnesota. And he says, oh, you're that foreign policy. Are you that foreign policy guy? Are you that guy that memorizes all that stuff and gets up front and knows all those really interesting facts and does a great program? I said, yes, that's me. I like getting confused with Tom Hansen. Let's give Tom a big round of applause tonight for a great program. Thanks. And as I said, we're not going to finish the conversation here. If you'd like to hand in your questions, we'll include those as part of the podcast. Again, huge thanks to Tom. What a great program again tonight, and for a very thoughtful preparation, and just a marvel to listen to you speak and share and connect us all to it. And we got to know about it. It's good for us to understand it, and we can only do better as a country and as a world if we understand, you know, what's going on. Again, I'd say if you're thinking about becoming a member, I encourage you to do so this evening. We have that great membership table outside, and we have opportunities for folks. We got to get a lot more people sitting and listening to things like this, getting chances to hear this kind of conversation. I'm sort of deputizing all of you to help us with that. Encourage some of your friends, your colleagues, people you think should be hearing this message. We're working hard to get people of all ages, all geographics, all together to learn more about these kinds of things and be able to study and understand our world just a little bit better. And if you are interested in membership tonight, we're sweetening the deal, of course, with those Great Decisions books. So if you'd like to be a part of that, please do that. We have some great programs coming up. We hope you'll come join us for. We have a program with the former Prime Minister of Ukraine and Nobel Prize laureate coming up on Ukraine and the future rebuilding of Ukraine. We have a Culture Through Cuisine spotlighting Ethiopia coming up. Ethiopian cuisine. We have a get to know, we're doing this new thing called Get to Know Minnesota, Global Minnesota. So about quarterly, we invite people to come to our office and just learn about I give a talk about the organization, what it's about. We've had lots of people joining us. Our last one, I think we had 30 folks come. So if you have folks that would like to learn about Global Minnesota, we have this great easy program to come and be a part of and make it kind of fun. Sustainable Development Goals Roundtable, Resiliency in a Water-Challenged World is coming up. Steve Riedel is putting together with his crew a really great program. We hope you'll come join us for that. And that's really a focus with our corporate members, but anybody can come join the program. We have a global social with 34 young entrepreneurs from 30 different countries coming. We have these young entrepreneurs, young people from Caribbean, Latin America, Canada are coming to join us. These are young, smart young professionals that are here to study and learn. And we're going to have a great global social with our friends at NOC coming up. So I hope you'll come join us for that. And on May 18th, our great gala. You got to come to the gala. Come sail away. We've got, you get a chance to sail down to Cape Town, Mumbai, Rio de Janeiro, Stockholm, and Sydney. It's all part of this wonderful event with food and entertainment and activities. We hope you'll come be a part of that. We got to give a huge thanks to these interpreters that have been up here tonight. They just do a tremendous job. And part of the reason they're able to be here is because of all of you, those that came to the gala and did our fund in need with us 2 years ago. That was to fund the cost of interpreters at our events. So we've been able to have that as part of our programs. And so we're super thankful for that. I got to give a huge thanks again to our board members, where's our board chair, Ross Wilson at?
Ross, raise your hand, wave your hand in the room. We got board and any other board members for Global Minnesota that are here, just raise your hands up. We have a wonderful board of directors that helps us to engage and to connect and to kind of move forward Global Minnesota. And we have this great paid staff here. Our paid staff members, Katie Kelly, who organized tonight's event, and our whole team is kind of all hands on deck to put these bigger events together. Please give them a round of applause, Steve and Nick and Kathleen and everyone that's here that making that possible for us. We're lucky to have such a nice crew of people working together. We're not a big outfit, but we like to think we punch above our weight class a little bit, in part because we have such tremendous partners and friends like the Humphrey that help us get it done. So thanks again to the Humphrey crew for helping us make this program again possible. And mostly just thanks again to all of you for being here tonight, for being a part of this conversation and this great thing we're trying to do together to lift up and understand just a bit more about our world, our state, and the people that are in it. So thanks, everybody. Have a great evening. And oh, I'm sorry, there's cookies. Lemonade, yes, outside, more conversation to be had. So please, I mean, we spared no expense, cookies and lemonade, folks. So it's lemonade, it's summertime out there. Come join us out there, enjoy your evening. Thanks everybody for being here tonight.